Before I start, I would like to acknowledge the study subjects, investigators, and staff at clinical trial sites, manufacturers and other sponsors, national and international public health and regulatory agencies for their participation, clinical trial conduct, support, and promotion of the trials that I'm about to describe, and they are too numerous to list for you. My main objective during this session is to provide you with an overview of recent pandemic influenza vaccine development, with a particular focus on vaccines for influenza A, H5N1 viruses. In the 10 years since the unprecedented epizootic outbreak of influenza A, H5N1 viruses, we've made a number of there have been a number of developments and a lot of progress in many areas, including epidemiologic, technical, political, economic, and conceptual areas. Specifically, we have expanded surveillance for influenza and other emerging viruses around the world. We have developed specific techniques, reverse genetics, that can be used for seed virus production of flu vaccines. We've developed assays and reagents for monitoring the progress of clinical trials and expanded the manufacturing capacity. We've enhanced international cooperation and started the process of technology transfer to developing countries, which will be very critical in maintaining a conversation between developed and developing world. And we have made an initial step in liability relief with regard to pandemic vaccines. Finally, this has stimulated a rethink of developing vaccines for influenza, and we are starting to explore other approaches using adjuvants, changing substrates for vaccine production, looking at the value of conserved influenza virus targets, and developing delivery devices and so forth. Nevertheless, there are a number of persisting and emerging challenges in the development process. The immunization needs remain poorly defined. And let's face it, we've had less than 400 identified human cases of influenza H5N1 infections with an over 60% case fatality ratio. Often these patients appear late and there's little opportunity to study in great detail the immune response to infection. The viruses, for unknown reasons, appear to be rather poorly immunogenic. There's been a lack of assay standardization around the world, which makes comparing results from clinical trials very difficult. As influenza viruses do, there is ongoing antigenic drift, and there have been a number of political and economic barriers, specifically with regard to funding of clinical trials, intellectual property issues, and persisting liability concerns. Just to highlight the antigenic drift and human disease, we now recognize at least 9 clades circulating in the bird population based on phylogenetic analyses of the hemagglutinin gene. And what I've shown you here is the way I like to look at phylogenetic trees, a rather simplified version of the clades that have been known to infect humans, the clade zero being the Hong Kong virus from 1997 with the initial human cases, clade 7 in China, clade 1 in China and Southeast Asia, and a prototype typical representative is the A Vietnam virus, vaccine virus. Clade 2.1 in Indonesia is an Indonesia strain for vaccine development. Clade 2.2 in China, Southeast Asia, Middle East, Europe, and Africa, represented by Turkey virus as a vaccine strain. And clade 2.3 circulating in China and Southeast Asia, with Anhui as being a selected candidate vaccine strain. Now, in the process of this development, which really has been underway seriously and aggressively since 2003-2004 reemergence, a number of themes have emerged. It's clear with the poor immunogenicity based on immune responses to the hemagglutinin that we can detect that dosage-sparing approaches are going to be needed. The ability of these pre-pandemic vaccines to elicit cross-reactive antibodies to drifted variants is a very high priority because we don't really know which clade will emerge. For that matter, we don't even know if it will be an influenza A H5N1 virus. The ability of the pre-pandemic vaccines to prime for responses to pandemic vaccines deserves further study, and I'll show you one Sentinel study that suggested pre-pandemic immunization could prime, and this would require a single dose only in the setting of early pandemic spread with the pandemic strain. And the results of clinical trials have been difficult to compare directly because of methodological differences, and we'll see how some of these areas are being addressed as we move along. Now, the approaches that we've taken basically are, this is just a laundry list of the approaches we take towards control of inter-pandemic flu as well, with some new twists and interests. Subunit non-adjuvanted vaccines, including subvirion, just disrupt the virus with a detergent, or a purified recombinant hemagglutinin, which can be cloned into insect cells and expressed and purified as a vaccine antigen. Adjuvanted subunit vaccines, only one currently is licensed in Europe for the control of inter-pandemic flu, and now adjuvants are being explored aggressively for use with these viruses in an attempt to spare antigen dosage. Whole virus vaccine technology was the most common up until the 60s and 70s, and in the United States, whole virus vaccines were basically abandoned in the 80s. Nevertheless, this is a tried and true approach, and the whole virus vaccines are being evaluated with and without adjuvants, and some of these are grown in eggs, which is the usual approach to growing influenza vaccines for control of inter-pandemic flu. Some of these are now being grown in cell cultures, and this is being developed for both inter-pandemic and pandemic influenza control. In addition, novel approaches exploring conserved epitopes, such as the nuclear protein and the extracellular domain of the M2 protein, DNA constructs, and other approaches are being used. Now, before I proceed, I just wanted to mention briefly how these vaccines are being evaluated from a regulatory standpoint. I will not discuss much today in terms of reactogenicity because of time, and I didn't set the timer. But I'm going to try and focus on either a significant rise in antibody titer, fourfold rise in titer, and in Europe as well as in the US FDA guidelines, that is an increase to a titer of at least 40 after vaccination, or if you had antibody detectable at the time of the first dose, then you have to have a fourfold rise, or the percent of subjects who achieve a titer of 40, which is considered a putative protective titer based on our understanding of serologic correlates of immunity. None of these are hard and fast, but they serve as some benchmarks for comparing and evaluating vaccines. The data I will present in general will be immune responses among healthy younger adults, 18 to 40 or 45 or sometimes up to 64 years old. And I'm going to display the immune responses after two doses of vaccine. In the United States, typically we have a 4-week dosing interval, whereas in Europe it more typically is a 3-week dosing interval between the first and the second dose. In most cases, I will present HAI antibody responses unless they were not reported. In certain circumstances, we'll look at neutralizing antibody levels. And on the x-axis of each of these graphs, I will show will be the dosage level in micrograms of hemagglutinin per dose. And unless otherwise indicated, these are egg-grown viruses. So let's start at the very beginning. The first attempt to develop a vaccine was quite problematic because the viruses are highly pathogenic, and when they try to grow them up in eggs, they killed the eggs. So they cloned the hemagglutinin and expressed it in insect into a baculovirus vector and expressed it in insect cells. And Trainer and his colleagues did a dose-ranging study of purified recombinant hemagglutinin starting at 25, 45, and 90 micrograms, once again, two doses. I'll remind you that the usual dosage is 15 micrograms of hemagglutinin. So you can see these are quite high. And after two doses of the highest dosage level, 90 micrograms each dose, less than 50% of subjects seroconverted. And then we got smart and we figured out how to tame the hemagglutinin by means of reverse genetics techniques so that these viruses could now be grown in eggs. And he reported a dose-ranging study and had remarkably similar results, only slightly higher than 50%, had HAI antibody responses after two doses of 90 micrograms. Well, this became very clear that we needed to develop both more sensitive assays as well as dosage sparing approaches to it. And so the first place to turn was to aluminum-containing adjuvants, because these, in the United States, are the only adjuvants that are approved for adjuvanting vaccines. And we see here four studies from around the world. This is France, the United States, this is Australia, and this is Russia, of subvirion vaccines with or without an aluminum adjuvant. And I guess I want to make two points here with these data. The first point is that, in my opinion, the addition of aluminum, at least the addition of aluminum hydroxide, did not substantially enhance the immunogenicity of the vaccine, and that the immune response rates, even after two relatively high dosage levels of vaccine, were still at best modest. And then the third point would be that we tend to have, in the United States, using our assays, a somewhat lower immune response rate, and that could be due to assay differences, which we'll look at in a minute. So we really needed to look at alternative adjuvants. And this slide shows you the results of studies conducted both in the United States and across the pond of subunit vaccines adjuvanted with various oil and water emulsion adjuvants. And I think it's very dramatic. You could see on the white bars, this is when the antigen is given without the adjuvant. And then the yellow bars in each slide. And I'll show you on this one, the scale, it goes up to 100% response rates, because we're seeing very substantially enhanced immune response rates with the addition of these oil and water emulsions. So this is a very promising approach. Nevertheless, there's less experience with these adjuvants, and the safety profile is not as well understood as the aluminum adjuvants. Now, one other possibility in the swine flu evaluations was suggested that whole virus vaccines may be more immunogenic than the subvirion vaccine. So investigators around the world, including the Japanese here, the Chinese here, and the Hungarians, have evaluated alum adjuvanted whole virus vaccines and have shown fairly immunogenic preparations after two doses here in the Japanese study, two 15 microgram doses, majority of subjects seroconvert. Likewise, with the Chinese vaccine, a majority of subjects seroconverted after two 10 microgram doses, which is a much higher seroconversion rate than we were seeing with some of the subvirion vaccines, the caveat being different assays, different countries, different labs. Now, the Hungarians have presented a single-dose trial of 6 micrograms of an alum aluminum phosphate adjuvanted whole virus vaccine and said that a majority of subjects seroconvert after a single dose. This appears to be very promising, but we really need confirmation in other laboratories and other hands. We really didn't know whether the aluminum adjuvant was adding anything to the whole virus vaccine, so we conducted a clinical trial of an alum aluminum hydroxide adjuvanted whole virus vaccine. And I will point out that the white bars here are non-adjuvanted vaccine and the yellow bars are adjuvanted vaccine. And we, as well as the Baxter investigators in Germany who conducted a parallel clinical trial, demonstrated that actually adding the aluminum hydroxide to this whole virus vaccine grown in Vero cells actually impaired the immunogenicity significantly. Now, I've made a point about assay issues, and so I felt that the best way to highlight this was to take a single set of sera that we knew were sera and run them in two different laboratories. So we had the opportunity to do so because we conducted a clinical trial with Baxter. So we sent Baxter the sera from our clinical trial, sera from 100 subjects. There were 300 sera pre-first dose, after the first dose, and after the second dose. And what I'm showing you here are the results in their lab, which is called Baxter Kistner, Ottfried Kistner, and SRI, which is the contract lab that's running the NIH clinical trials. And I picked an endpoint in the assay, a neutralizing titer of at least 20, which some believe might be considered as a correlate of protection. And you can see there were considerable differences in the level of sensitivity in the lab that is running the Baxter's here are compared to, with the NIH lab. And what this means and where we move go from here is not entirely clear. However, it has been proposed by Dr. John Wood that a solution to approach these assay differences, these assays that are run are quite different if you read the methodologies, is to include in the assay international standards against which you could adjust titers. And an experiment is underway in at least 17 labs across the globe to see whether inclusion of an international antibody standard can help us have a frame of reference for comparing different studies. Now, one of the other possibilities was that if you administered vaccine intradermally as opposed to intramuscularly, you could use reduced dosages. And we, in fact, did an hypothesis testing trial. Our lead investigator here is a trainee, Sheetal Patel. And she assessed the immune responses to 30 micrograms, two doses of 30 micrograms given either intradermally or intramuscularly. And for those of you who remember intradermal administration, we had no special device. We were using the MAN2 technique. And you can see that after two doses of intradermal compared with intramuscular, there was a somewhat higher response frequency, but these differences were not significant. Another approach is to develop live attenuated vaccines, and there have been vaccines in the United States developed by Brian Murphy and Conte Sabaro's lab and tested by Ruth Caron against influenza A, H9N2, H5N1, and now H7N3. And we've seen some differences in results. The H9N2 are highly immunogenic, but they don't grow very well. The H5s don't grow, and they don't elicit an immune response. And the H7 vaccine has modest immunogenicity and a somewhat higher rate of virus shedding. The Russians, using a different master donor for the live attenuated virus, are showing higher immune response frequencies and shedding. And so it will be interesting to compare differences between their master donors and our master donors. Now, I alluded to the fact that we don't really know if it will even be H5N1. In fact, in recent years, H2N2 has been a concern because most of the world's population is susceptible to this virus, and it caused a pandemic in 1957. And furthermore, there have been several outbreaks, recent outbreaks in pigs, and we always used to consider pigs as being the mixing vessels which would permit the jump to humans. H7N7 viruses caused a large outbreak in poultry in the Netherlands that resulted in a number of human infections and the death of one veterinarian in 2003. And our site is at Baylor College of Medicine is now conducting an NIH trial of a candidate H7N7 vaccine. And finally, H9N2 caused several human infections in 1999 in Hong Kong, and a number of studies have explored the various candidates for this particular strain. Cross-reactivity is very important because we have a pre-pandemic virus. We'd like to know that that vaccine will stimulate antibody that will cross-react to a drifted variant that we don't know what the drifted variant will be. And these data show you the results from a clinical trial of an MF59, an oil and water adjuvanted vaccine against A. Vietnam being a clade 1 virus, and the sera were then tested for antibody against clade 2.1, clade 2.2, and clade 2.3 viruses. And I think you can see that the adjuvanted vaccine elicited relatively good antibody responses against other drifted viruses. Finally, Trainer and his colleagues, who did the initial recombinant hemagglutinin trial, got these people back years after they had received their two doses of vaccine, and then gave them a dose of A. Vietnam, and this is their immune response after a single dose if they had been primed with the A. Hong Kong variant, the clade 0 virus. So this gives us some hope that pre-pandemic priming may have some role. So what have we learned? Higher than expected dosages of H5 hemagglutinin appear necessary to stimulate responses in most people. Aluminum-containing adjuvants have conferred, in my opinion, at least with the aluminum hydroxide adjuvants, little meaningful benefit. Their dosage dependence and formulation differences deserve additional study. Some whole virus vaccines and oil and water adjuvants appear very promising. Expanded studies are necessary to confirm safety and immunogenicity in other populations. Pre-pandemic immunization or priming is a potentially useful strategy, and development of international standards should help us compare results from trials around the world. So I don't know what my time is. Do you know what my time is? Wrap it up. Okay. I would like to make the point, that not all vaccines are useful for all circumstances. For example, subunit vaccines have a long track record of safety. There could be broad indications based on age down to 6 months, presence of underlying diseases or pregnancy, and they use licensed processes, but they may require high dosage levels. Subunit vaccines with adjuvants have a tremendous antigen-sparing potential, but there are potential safety concerns, there is some increased reactogenicity, and they may be more expensive. Whole virus vaccines may have antigen-sparing capability, and they utilize current and or past licensed processes, but they have been shown to cause fever in young children, and this needs to be explored. And then live attenuated vaccines could potentially, if we could get them to be immunogenic and infectious, could potentially require only a single dose and may give some early protection in the early spread of a pandemic. But they may not be able to be, there are safety issues with regard to age, underlying health, immune status. So finally, all of the efforts that we have been making in recent years to improve immunization against inter-pandemic influenza have fueled the process of developing vaccines for pandemic influenza viruses and vice versa. And these efforts have included enhancing surveillance, global surveillance for influenza, expanding production capacity, speeding up the vaccine production process, developing alternative methods and substrates for making these vaccines, improved adjuvants, conserved antigens. There are new delivery devices that may permit more immunogenic intradermal immunization, for example, and expanding the use of vaccines and antivirals, without which there will be little incentive for industry to continue large-scale production of vaccines for interpandemic flu. With that, I will end. Thank you.